My name is Mike Smith. The title of this session is Bill Newt and Future U.S. Foreign Policy. Perhaps it should be Bill Jesse and Future U.S. Foreign Policy, because I see Jesse Helms in Congress taking a stronger stance, having a more clear set of commitments than I think Newt Gingrich has. But my aim was, since the Republicans have taken charge of the Congress, my aim was to try to, this was as much out of my own interest as anything else, try to figure out where are they headed? What are they trying to do? And before it seemed to me that it made sense to ask that question, the prior question was, what is Bill Clinton trying to do? So I, in a somewhat unsystematic way, have been trying to figure that out and then lead on to the next question. Now, the question about the Republicans in the Congress. To put this into context, this week my wife and I have done a series of sessions. My wife did a couple sessions on domestic policy and the budget, on welfare policy and on the budget. And then this is the second foreign policy session that I will have done. The way we saw this relating to the overall theme of the summer, the foretaste of the feast to come, is we were sort of asking questions about who's invited to the table, who sits at the table. Who shares in the feast or whatever, trying to make a connection of the political to that larger theme. Now that can be difficult. And I was reminded, I guess during Bible study this morning, I was reminded of something I realized only very recently, and I should have realized a long time ago. Political scientists, I think it's in the nature of the breed, we tend to think that politics is the most important thing there is. We are fascinated by politics and government. And I have seen myself, among other things, as a political theorist for 20 years, but only a few years ago did it occur to me that is not most important. Politics and government is not most important. If you accept the idea that we do not expect government, society on earth to be heaven, and we don't expect to create a heaven on earth, then that doesn't acquire that kind of priority. But that's something political scientists are burdened with, and it then becomes a problem for me explaining why I spend time talking about politics and government if it's not most important. And I guess I would say it is still important. It does have importance, and there's a reason for people with religious concerns to think about politics. Because I am a trained political scientist, rather than a trained theologian or anything, what I can talk about is politics. I really don't have expertise in the other area. And that's what I want to do. What I've done to talk about these subjects, I spent some time trying to examine Clinton foreign policy and trying to figure out if I can find a pattern there, what pattern is there in Clinton foreign policy. And then to prepare for this more particularly, I've been looking at Congress and what's been coming out in the House and the Senate in Congress. I think quite possibly I've missed some things. So anything that you've observed that can add to this, please offer those observations and comments and ask any questions you have. So with that, and so really at any point, this is yesterday the way I set it up, I wanted to have small groups in the middle. Today I welcome comments at any point. And the way that this will proceed, first thing I want to talk about is Clinton campaign promises. What did Clinton say in the campaign about foreign policy, and how does it compare with what's actually happened? And I do that because I think on a number of campaign promises or commitments, Clinton changed his mind after he got in, or even before he got into the White House. On Haiti, he changed his Haiti policy before he was even president. So, that's where I think one starts, and then proceed to more general themes in the administration, and then from there move on to the Republicans and what they've been talking about this year. And I've put this stuff on overheads, and so I start with the campaign promises. The campaign promises that I identified NAFTA was a real issue, a major issue in the campaign. Clinton tried to take a stance, I think, between Perot and Bush, said that he did support NAFTA, as Bush did, and Perot, of course, criticized NAFTA, but he wanted side agreements concerning the environment and jobs. And I think once he was in office, that's what he proceeded to do, was to see to the negotiation of side agreements and then get NAFTA approved by the Congress, which was, if you recall, a tight battle, and succeeded because of Republican support. It was the Republicans that made the approval of NAFTA possible. Second campaign promise regarded the Haitian refugees, that he said we welcome them with open arms. And even before he was president, as apparently the Haitians were building boats and planning in mass to come over here, he changed his stance on that so that there would not be a flood of refugees at the same time that he was inaugurated. Gays in the military, I do not recall this being a big issue during the campaign. He obviously made some comments about it, and that became an early issue in his administration, and he decided to set up a commission to make a recommendation and then accepted the recommendation of the commission, a sort of political solution to the issue that had been raised. During the campaign, he said he was morally opposed to rewarding aggression in Bosnia, talking about the Serbs and the fact that the Serbs that had probably a legitimate claim to maybe 30% of Bosnia occupied 60 or 70% of Bosnia. He didn't want to approve that or ratify that, he said during the campaign. But since taking office, I think he's been very leery of any major U.S. commitment in Bosnia. So he's sort of straddled the fence on that, I suppose. And on human rights in China, he criticized the Bush administration for not being tough on China and insisting on human rights. This was the standard Democratic line. This was the line that Democrats in Congress had taken. Once in office, and I'm not sure, I think this is really 94 when he makes the change on this, but during the spring of 94, apparently, he became convinced that trade was more important. We'd been holding out saying we're going to deny most favored nation if they don't make improvements in human rights. That's what he said in 93. In 94, he backed away from that. We're not going to make most favored nation depend on human rights performance. So that's what I came up with. Do you any comments on any of these points or any other things that occur to you as?
What was his position on Cuba during the campaign?
I can't say. I don't know.
He's come down really tough on that since the election, which I think surprised a lot.
The one sense I have about Cuba is regarding the refugee issue. I think once he, his initial attitude, it seems to me he's trying to be consistent. He's saying, we're letting Cuban refugees in, so we ought to let Haitian refugees in. When he was let known, I think the foreign policy establishment let him know that doesn't make sense to let the Haitian refugees in, so he backed off on that. Then he got tougher on the Cuban refugees, and now he has Republicans criticizing him for being so tough on Cuban refugees. But I think, to some extent, all he's trying to do is be consistent.
And yet he's willing to grant China most favored nation status, even though they have extreme violations of human rights.
And we're still...
Cuba remains a pariah.
We seem to, in the same way that during the 1960s, we had a thing about China that we couldn't recognize them or whatever, and even into the 70s, we have a similar problem with Cuba. I don't know what attitudes you have on Cuba. I'm trained in the old realist school that says you talk to everybody. You don't deny recognition just because you disapprove of a regime.
Isn't the thinking in both Democrats and Republicans nationally that until Castro is gone,
well, I think Castro may be a major obstacle.
I mean, when he's gone, that whatever the government there, that things will change rapidly.
Yeah.
Not in Cuba necessarily, but in the U.S. posture.
Attitude toward Cuba.
I don't think we're going to wait, though. Other countries are going in there and preemptiveness right now.
And that was what happened in Vietnam.
Yeah.
The economic opportunities became overwhelming.
Yep.
Cuba's awfully close.
Cuba.
But he, one thing that you don't have down here that, I don't know if it was in his campaign or not, but his recent, I guess you could call it victory related to the Japanese car importing.
Mm-hmm.
Sessions ago, although I'm not sure how they're enforceable, but that was one of his few really major victories in recent months.
Well, actually, we're going to come to that sort of thing later on. I'm not sure that it was a major campaign promise, an explicit campaign
it
promise.
It wasn't something that was an issue. I don't know whether Clinton said anything, but certainly Bush was trying to grapple with that toward the tail end of his administration.
Well, we have been making agreements about automobiles with Japan since the early 1980s, and many of them have been voluntary agreements. So far as I know, the Japanese have pretty much kept all those voluntary commitments, but what they managed to do is they managed to use them in some way that we hadn't anticipated. So they were able to profit. You know, we thought, well, here's a good deal, and now we're getting one up on the Japanese, and then, surprise, they were able to, it wasn't a serious obstacle. They had agreed to limit the number of automobiles they sold in the United States. So what they did was, they went from selling very small, inexpensive compacts to moving up higher grade. They said, yeah, we are going to send you any more than 1.8 million cars a year, but we're going to send you more expensive cars, and we're going to take your market away from you in the higher end, where the profits are to be made. They committed about 5-6 years ago. They said we will buy $19 billion in auto car parts from you, but something like 18 out of the 19 they use in their factories in the U.S. So yes, they bought almost all. You know, they bought all the car parts they promised to buy. They did not send them to Japan, and that was our aim, was to sell more to Japan. So
expand here, but to use our stuff there.
Yeah. So. My impression is, yes, we've made a number of voluntary agreements, they've kept them, but we have not benefited as much as we thought we were going to from those agreements. And this is another one. And we'll see what comes from it. Any other thoughts about the campaign promises? One other little thing I stumbled across after I put this together, and so I didn't go back to my computer to add it. Apparently, I ran across this because of a campaign promise Bob Dole has, or commitment he has now made. Apparently, Clinton said that he approved the idea of moving the capital of Israel to Jerusalem, which has been a thorny political issue. And our official position has long been that that's for the Palestinians and the Israelis, or the Arabs and the Israelis, to decide. That's not for us to decide. Once he was in office, Clinton changed his mind, decided Tel Aviv is a good place for the U.S. embassy, that we were not going to move the embassy, which would be our way of recognizing the claim that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Dole now is in favor of regarding Jerusalem, moving the embassy regarding Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So it goes on. Any other thoughts in terms of what you expected? I mean, Clinton did not run as a foreign policy expert, and so we didn't get as much of a sense of a grand foreign policy from Clinton as you might expect from someone who did run as a experienced foreign policy practitioner. But was there anything else you had a sense of that this is what Clinton aims to do as president back during the campaign? More often he avoided foreign policy than talked about them, I think. Well, I would suggest a couple things. First thing I would suggest is that, let me move this around, is I think, and this is a little vague, but I think you have a somewhat dovish, can't do this. You'll just have to ignore the top part. I'm not good at moving these things. Anyway, I think a dovish post-Vietnam military posture. He inherited, at least what tends to happen is the people who take the top foreign policy positions in an administration were the people who were involved in the previous administration of that party. So you get people who were a little lower ranking in the Carter administration become the top policymakers in the Clinton administration. And I think the issue that the Carter administration grappled with but never resolved is, if we're not going to have a Cold War foreign policy, if we're not going to have the traditional American foreign policy, and if we think Vietnam was a mistake, we agree with the dovish criticisms of Vietnam, what do we do? What is our foreign policy? I think Anthony Lake in particular has spent the last decade or two trying to figure that out, and Warren Christopher to some extent has been trying to figure that out. Part of the answer, I think, is to use other foreign policy instruments than force. It is a reticence about the use of force. Use diplomacy, use economic incentives, economic sanctions, and so forth to achieve objectives. And as I say, a disinclination to use force. And at the same time, a peculiar attitude that says there are these humanitarian problems around the world and we should do something about them. That previously we didn't do something about humanitarian problems, but we need to do something about them. And in fact, we may use force. We may send troops in or something to resolve humanitarian problems or failure to establish democracy or democratic reversals as in Haiti or whatever. And my sense is that the attitude towards Somalia, even though that was initiated by Bush, that the attitude toward Bosnia and also the attitude toward Haiti was motivated by these sorts of thoughts. Now, I'm throwing this out because I haven't seen much other than one or two articles in the Washington Post that say this, or maybe a little bit in Newsweek when we were, I don't know, 6 months or a year ago, revealing who really is Anthony Lake, who are these people. What do you think? Can you see a hesitation about the use of force, but a greater commitment to try to address humanitarian?
Doesn't that follow with all the political fighting over which side, the Democrats or the Republicans or whoever, are the most moral, that it would be okay to use military force because we're doing humanitarian?
We're doing good things.
As opposed to just lining our own economic pockets or taking over, making somebody do something we want. But it's kind of the same type of issue that in politics everybody's claiming the high road, or trying to.
Yeah. And one of the things going back to Carter made an issue out of human rights. He was concerned about human rights. The spin that the Reagan administration put on that was terrorism violates human rights. We are concerned about terrorism, but that's human rights also. And so I think there's been a little bit of a struggle. What human rights? We all want to promote democracy, but what exactly do we mean, and how do you go about promoting democracy? So I think those are some things, and I think you're absolutely right. Each side is posturing around that with similar goals, dissimilar means. Any other? There's not a lot of room for indicating this. Maybe this colors the attitude toward Russia and the republics in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics.
Do you think there'll be a change in that now as the election approaches and any of these policies, particularly the last one?
I think that's already changed. My sense is after what happened in Somalia, that the administration became very hesitant about peacekeeping operations that had any substantial commitment of U.S. forces. I think one of the reasons we've been so eager to get as many American troops out of Haiti as fast as we wanted to is we don't want casualties. We like peacekeeping. We don't want Americans to die for peacekeeping purposes. I've run across articles that argue that we misjudge, that the politicians misjudge the American people. But the politicians' attitude is, if you start having American casualties, your popularity is just going to go down the tubes.
They don't realize there just as many casualties training down in Louisiana as there are over somewhere else.
Yeah, the,
it's
a handful of casualties, but it's enough to change policies. Which may be part of Clinton's lack of resolution. Going gets a little tough with, you know.
That with the growing arsenal of terrorists in the world, I mean, the capability of even one or two people to have powerful weapons. The risk we run, it seems, is that if we appear very timid and not ready to respond in any situation, then it doesn't become sort of an invitation to more terrorism. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that, but if the government appears timid in how it exercises its authority and its power.
And that, I think, you know, that was how I first responded, reacted to your question is, if a crisis were to arise and Clinton were to appear irresolute, indecisive, that would be terribly damaging to his re-election chances, it seems to me. You know, if he's already a little weak or a little soft on the use of military force, if irresolution would be very hurtful, I think.
What about the Iraqi threat to Kuwait last year? Yes, troop will have troops. Wasn't he
resolute?
Force
perhaps more than he needed to be. But it's to me, it's like the impression people had, if you remember the Newsweek cover, that George Bush was a wimp. Once you've been tagged as a wimp, you can do half a dozen good unwimpish things, and you do one or two wimpish things, and it's all down the tubes. And that's my sense about Clinton, is he can be resolute any number of times. We have the image of him waffling. He cannot afford to waffle on anything big. The North Korea, the stuff with North Korea, I think has been pretty touchy. They've not been pushed to the wall yet on that.
There's one thing, I don't really see it there, but there seems to be a transformation of our military itself into a B-1 bomber transformation, shifting from the B-52s to the SAC. Strike force that can deliver high speed firepower to a smaller. It's a transformation.
Okay, I think there are a number of changes in the defense area going on. I really have not addressed them too much here. One of the things the administration did, they had what they called a ground up review of the defense department and the military capabilities. They have tried to restructure defense in light of this ground-up review, which is supposed to be thoughtful about what the threats are and how we structure the military to respond to that. At the same time, we've been cutting back on spending in defense. So they've been trying to, within the constraints of the budget, restructure American defense capabilities to meet the threats that they foresee as potential future threats. And a lot of that is not very visible unless you're close to it, I think.
Well, no. Is the CIA handling more of the things? No. For instance, like in the Iraqi thing when all the terrorists were going out and teams and coming this way, and CIA handled more than the military did really over here in this country.
At this point, there is a debate going on in Congress about what the CIA ought to be doing. The old mission is not, which was really penetrate the Soviet Union, has substantially disappeared. It is not the threat that it was. We are spending a lot of money on the CIA, on intelligence. What should they be doing? And some people want to cut that back substantially, and some people want to retarget it in particular areas. If you recall a few months ago when we had embassy personnel in Paris kicked out of France, that was, we apparently had stolen some industrial secrets from the French. We got some deals, I think, in the Middle East because of this industrial espionage carried on by our intelligence people, and then they shared the information with our business, our corporate people, who made some deals, beat out the French, and the French got mad. And so they kicked out American diplomats to punish us for it. That's one other direction that intelligence is talking about.
I'm thinking particularly of terrorist control, which is probably...
Yeah, I'm not sure if we have more or less of a problem of terrorism today.
It's more dramatic, though, because we see that live on TV.
Well, if you think about how much of the terrorism revolved around the Middle East, and to the extent that there is now some Palestinian territory, there are a number of outlying groups, in Japan, Ireland, and other places. But part of the connection was they had places they could go, like Iraq for training. They could count on certain sources for supplies, such perhaps as the Soviet Union. Some of that's dried up. I don't want to say there isn't a serious terrorist threat, or it may in fact be growing, but I'm not sure it is.
Has Clinton never taken a stand on the School for the Americas? That's been a controversial.
I can't say. I don't know.
Can you explain why, I missed it in the reports, that's all, why Levine and, the Arab side came to Washington to sign their agreement?
Arafat?
Arafat. What did we have to do with that agreement?
We didn't have very much to do with that agreement. That agreement was what worked out in Norway, I think. It was some Norwegian diplomats saw an opportunity, got these sides together, talked to them, and pretty much got a peace agreement. What is the U.S. role in this? We have been bankrolling peace in the Middle East. We are the major player in the world. We are the number one power, far beyond any number two power. Now, partly what makes the agreement possible is there isn't a number two power. When it was U.S. and Russia, we take one side, Russia takes the other, or Soviet Union takes the other side. When there is no number two, we're the only place. You come here to cement your agreements. But we've been paying, in terms of foreign aid, we've been giving Israel $3 billion a year in foreign aid every year since Camp David, and we've been giving Egypt over $2 billion a year in foreign aid, which is partly because Israel has a very effective lobby in the United States, but it's partly because that was how we paid for the Camp David Accords. So I think there's an expectation, you come to Uncle Sam to pay for peace.
That's foreign policy.
We, in turn, say the Saudis and others ought to pay for peace, that we can't afford to pay the Palestinians to rebuild their economy. Someone else ought to pay for that. So the Palestinians, as I understand it, are in dire straits right now because they aren't getting the aid that they need. Let me move on. There's another element that I do want to talk about, and it comes to the trade issue. This has been, I think, a relatively... invisible element of the Clinton foreign policy, and that's an aggressive economic policy. Clinton, the central message, I think, more than anything else of the Clinton campaign in 1992 was jobs. Get jobs for Americans. We have shown more growth in the export sector than we show in the internal market. We are showing more expansion and thus more hiring percentage-wise in export than we are in producing and selling and providing services to ourselves. The Democrats are less leery of having an industrial policy, of having government involved in stimulating the economy, in encouraging potentially profitable economic enterprises. So where my sense is that Reagan and Bush both tended to neglect this area, programs in this area that Clinton has been pushing in this area, trying to increase U.S. competitiveness and trying to increase U.S. exports, seeing a potential big payoff in jobs. I think that's part of the reason education is so important. Do you know his Secretary of Labor?
Right.
Who argues that the way you're going to maintain good jobs and good wages in any country, you have to have a highly trained, skilled workforce. That multinational companies can go anywhere to hire people. They aren't bound to the United States. They don't have to stay here. So if we are going to keep our multinationals here and attract others and attract investments and have a workforce that makes good money, the only way to do that is to have a highly trained workforce. So education is central to any such goals.
What has been the impact of these multinationals versus international corporations?
Well, there is a debate, and I think it's a little different from what I hear you asking. Reich says our multinationals are truly international, that they aren't tied to the United States, that if they can move plants elsewhere, they will do it. There's some feeling that the multinational corporations of some other countries are more tied to home, that Japanese multinationals mostly do business with other Japanese businesses. If they come to the United States and set up a plant here, they would prefer to buy products from other Japanese firms. We see the whole world as a market and move anywhere, we'll move our headquarters. We save money by moving the headquarters somewhere, we move the headquarters. They keep the headquarters in Japan. So there's some question whether everyone's playing by the same rules we play by. So part of this then when we get down to the bottom here, NAFTA, you could have expected a Democrat to be against NAFTA. That was certainly plausible. You have Democrats. Part of the reason Clinton had trouble getting NAFTA through Congress, through the House, was Democratic opposition. He had to overcome Democratic opposition. GATT came shortly, this agreement came shortly after the NAFTA agreement, another kind of commitment to free trade, saying we want to reduce barriers to trade. We want to open things up, and partly we want more rules about the things we're good at. We are good at services. We are good at a number of leading industries, but we're getting ripped off by the Pakistani. They steal our computer software, put out their pirate copies. They steal our movies. They steal our videos. Other things. We need rules about that. And that was part of what GATT was supposed to address. I think the loan guarantee, which was very unpopular in this country, to Mexico. What is Mexico? Our number three export market or something like that? Maybe number two. If their economy is in serious trouble, that's going to hurt our exports. We bail them out because financially we don't have any other choice.
We haven't heard much in the news about that lately, but what was written at the time was that this was too little, too late. It's interesting how the press has not really followed that story. Maybe during the campaign, he's here.
Well, it's the kind of thing that if it fails, we will hear a lot about it, and if it succeeds, we probably won't hear much about it until you get to the campaign. Clinton is a good campaigner. I think he has some successes, and you'll hear about them during the campaign, but maybe not until then. I tend to believe he doesn't get real good press. I don't think the press is a whole lot in his ballpark.
There are a news
ballpark
a few months ago about his accomplishments that nobody knew.
Well, there was about 2 weeks when the Washington Post and Newsweek and other periodicals said, we're not being fair to Clinton. Everybody came out, they all admitted it at the same time, then back to business as usual, now that we've admitted that.
Back to selling to
him. Yeah.
There was
a president likes such a president.
Yeah. And that's true, too.
Yeah.
Since Richard Nixon, the press has been hard on presidents.
Isn't this economic emphasis of the Democrats that's been traditionally a Republican emphasis? Is that not going to be a problem for the Republicans in this coming election? Is that
well,
be able to look at?
The difference for the Democrats is that the Republicans tend to be laissez-faire. And you get a peculiar combination, and it's probably a contradiction within the Democratic package. But they're trying to be, they want to intervene a lot, and they want to help industries. They also want free trade. I mean, that's what GATT and NAFTA are about, free trade. But we want to help stimulate our industries. Well, that was part of what they negotiated in GATT, was ending subsidies, was reducing subsidies. So those two come into contradiction. The Republican attitude, I think, more often is, leave it alone. Why give money to the Export-Import Bank that encourages U.S. exports? I mean, that's interfering in the market. Let the market operate. Let our businessmen compete on you know, even turf. So,
but there's a
Republicans,
problem that the other countries don't operate on that.
Those principles.
Yeah, Japan, for instance, supports heavily supports their industries, their government.
Don't we also support a lot of industries through grants and other funding, for especially for research
and development?
Yeah.
Types of things.
And this is part, but to come to the Japan argument, this is part of the point of the tough trade talks with Japan, that we want to open up their market. We don't want to close our market as much as theirs is closed. We want to open up their market and sell to them. And we have had, within the last year, tough talks both with China. You know, these kinds of things, when you reach a resolution, then you forget about it. It seems like within 2 weeks or a month. But we seem to be at loggerheads with China, then we reached some kind of resolution, then we all went home happy. I'm not convinced we got as much from Japan, anywhere near as much as we wanted. But Mickey Cantor apparently decided we weren't going to get anything more. So take what you've got now, claim a victory. This, I think the Democrats learned from Reagan. You go ahead and negotiate, claim you won, and who's to say?
I'm just going to comment. I think one of the fundamental problems we're going to continue to have with China and Japan is that most U.S. businesses have never really put in the effort to understand the markets there. And having lived there, I can truly say that was my impression.
Yeah.
That they may give superficial efforts at doing that, but as opposed to the Japanese and Chinese, I know here in the state of Washington, in the fruit industry, I mean, they've got people all over the place learning everything they can about how we do things here,
and
really making an effort to understand how our system works.
I come from Port Angeles, and there's a mill up there, Nishawa, that's owned by the Japanese, and they have people that come over and stay for all the time.
There's a what?
A mill.
A mill.
Japanese-owned mill, Nishawa. And, you know, they come, and they spend, you know, 5 to 10 years in the community, and they become part of the community.
Well, there are a couple points about this. One, I think, is when I was looking at the Japanese trade issue, because I thought I might do a presentation on that, but I'm not. But when I was looking at that issue, the Japanese do seem to have made it a little bit harder to sell for Americans to sell cars in Japan. But I think at the same time, because it's a little bit harder, the American automakers said, hey, it's easier to sell cars, I don't know, in Thailand or Cambodia or India. There are a lot of other places. Hey, it's easier to break into that market. Why should we devote the time and the resources to take 10 years to really break in and establish a presence in the Japanese auto market, and it's only growing at 2% a year? Japanese, they're not buying a lot more cars every year. The other markets are growing faster. They're easier to penetrate. We'll go elsewhere. So it may, you know, both sides are somewhat true.
But we didn't put the steering wheel on the right side for them over there. It's no wonder that people don't want to drive our cars. It was just recently that the U.S. company started to.
But James Fallows argues, he says that's baloney. He says, yeah, but you sell them, you ship them a Mustang, they'll buy a Mustang, wherever the steering wheel is. But you have to have dealerships. And the Japanese dealers will not sell American cars. You have to establish a set of dealerships. Apparently Ford is working on doing that.
Did Chrysler just buy a chain or something like that?
If they did, I missed it.
But
Ford is trying to, from my reading, Ford is trying to break in.
Yeah, like 200 additional dealerships each year.
That's part of the agreement. Well, let's shift to the Republicans. We want to give them a chance here. I have to preview this by saying I didn't find a whole lot new. I thought maybe I would find some real interesting ideas that the, you know, Republicans had been thinking about where they wanted to lead our foreign policy. I didn't find a whole lot about that. But I did find some things, and so I want to indicate some of the kinds of things that I did find. And what I've got this down, I have some, what I'm calling some themes of the, what, the emerging Republican responses. Now, this is based on just reading about Congress and seeing what Republicans, especially leading Republicans, seem to be talking about, what's being included in the major legislation about foreign policy. What seems to be a very big theme is cut the budget deficit. An awful lot of Republicans feel like they were elected to do that more than anything else. And so that affects their approach to foreign policy. What the budget process involves the House and the Senate both passing budget resolutions fairly early in the year and trying to reconcile them. They tried to do that by May 15th. They, I think, finished reconciling their budget resolutions a week ago, something like that. I'm not sure what's in it. The Senate defense is the big spending item in foreign policy. Far and away, much larger than anything else in foreign policy, is defense spending. The Republicans in the Senate accepted Clinton's projections for the next 5 years. They said, that's fine, we can live with the amount of money Clinton wants to spend. That is the pressure, given the Republicans generally are pro-defense, that's the pressure of the budget deficit. The Republicans in the House said, no, we've got to spend a little more. They were talking in terms of $10 billion a year more for defense than Clinton had projected, and then the Senate Democrats were talking about. My impression is they split the difference when they had to reach an agreement between the two. But even that won't keep up with inflation. Even what the House was talking about would not keep up with inflation. So they're not talking about major increases in defense spending. Now, the dollar amounts year by year will go up, but that's inflation and population growth. They are definitely talking about cutting foreign aid. Israel sacrosanct, however. Israel and Egypt are sacrosanct. We're spending, a quarter of the present foreign aid budget on Israel and Egypt. We would spend a third of the foreign aid budget on it. You know, we're not going to cut their money. We're going to cut other places, and that's especially Africa. Africa does not have much clientele here, so cut foreign aid to Africa.
Truman started that policy early with his famous statement, didn't he, when they asked him why he recognized Israel so soon?
I don't recall the statement. What did he say?
He said, well, there just aren't that many Arab voters in the United States.
You
told the truth. You know.
That lobby is a powerful lobby. Oh. And it's a powerful lobby with the Republicans as well as the Democrats. Yeah. On the other hand, you know, I said to myself, if you figure maybe 3% of Americans are farmers, are involved in farm work, and they get $25 billion, and 3% of Americans are Jewish, and they get $5 billion between Israel and Egypt, then we're not doing too bad.
I don't know.
International organizations, Republicans don't seem to like them a whole lot. They'd rather we control our foreign aid. What happens with international aid organizations, you give it to somebody else, they decide who gets it.
This
would be UN, UN, yeah, development program, other UN agencies. It would include things, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, the Asian Bank, your regional banks, all those kinds of things that we give, multilateral lending institutions we give money to. Republicans would rather we control. There's an idea, interestingly, this originated in the administration. Warren Christopher said, let's combine the Arms Control Agency, the Foreign Aid Agency, and the USIA, the Information or Propaganda Agency. So let's combine all of those into the State Department. They objected, the bureaucrats objected, went to Al Gore. Gore said, you're right, we won't do that, shut up, Christopher. And Jesse Helms said, hey, that's a great idea. I like that idea. And so the Republicans in both houses, House and Senate, are pushing consolidate. And Helms is also pushing cut personnel. We don't need so many people in those programs. And then in Department of Defense, they say we've cut the military personnel as much as we can afford, but we can cut civilian personnel, so reduce the number of civilian personnel in the defense area. So this is all budget proposals, budget deficit proposals.
Are both parties still strong on the asset?
I have read a little bit about that, and I can't answer that. I don't recall. I don't recall that being a strong theme anywhere. My sense is that the support for NASA is not that strong overall, but I can't.
What are you talking about, NASA?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you said NASA.
Yeah. Now, it's, in a sense, once we went to the moon, do we really need a space station? They've cut back the space station they're talking about. They had grandiose designs. Obviously, that wasn't going to fly, so they went back to a smaller, simpler space station.
Wasn't that part of what they were also concerned about, that the recent link up go off without a hitch?
Yeah.
And get as much publicity as possible so that nobody would be able to say that the program wasn't working, let's get rid of it.
Yeah, NASA cannot afford disasters. We don't need more failures in NASA. There was talk 5 years ago about a mission to Mars, a combined U.S.-Russian mission to Mars. That would be big. That would be a dream.
And you still hear that every so often. My thought is that when people say that, that's kind of a pipe dream that they're willing to say, okay, this is what we want, but we'll settle for a nice space station.
Could be. But the mission to the moon was a dream that inspired a decade. Well, some other themes. The Republicans do not, sorry about that, I do not identify those two. The Republicans don't like UN peacekeeping a whole lot. I put blip after the first of these, you've probably heard of this issue, that we don't want U.S. troops under foreign command in a UN operation. To me, that this argument, and I could be wrong, but to me this argument is more a symbolic issue than a genuine issue. In the legislation they've written, they will allow the president to waive this requirement. We will allow U.S. troops to be under foreign command in NATO operations or other operations, just not in UN operations. So to me this is more of a symbolic saying, we don't like those things. You don't probably like them either. We all don't like them. Then it's any real concern. The Republicans raise the issue. They say we're doing too much to support UN peacekeeping. That on the one hand we have an allotment that is our share of the cost, but in addition to that we're providing lots of support, and we're not billing the UN, or we're not getting enough money back from the UN for all that support we give. That issue can be debated back and forth, but the Republicans say we want to charge them for the support we give. That will come out of our allotment, which I think is an argument that has on the face of it a lot of appeal. So they're planning on one way or another cutting back financial and in-kind support of UN peacekeeping. That's in their legislation. At least a couple weeks ago, when Bill Clinton seemed to be, when I was doing this, and Bill Clinton was talking about the circumstances under which we would send troops into Bosnia, the Republicans seemed terribly afraid of sending troops into Bosnia under any circumstances. You recall that? And I don't know. I suppose they all wanted to get on record, so if we sent troops in and there was some sort of disaster, then they could say, we told you so. The problem for presidential candidates like Bob Dole, who has been pressing the administration to be tougher on Bosnia all along, is how can you take both sides of that issue? Be tougher on them, but you know, don't send troops in. So it's problematic. But they haven't liked UN peacekeeping, and the administration itself, I think, has backed away since Somalia. But they're going to make it even tougher, I think, to do that sort of thing. In the defense area, what they're talking about is defense modernization. They say, we haven't developed new weapons in a long time. We're using bright weapons developed in the 70s or early 1980s. You know, we need a new generation of new weapons. And we can't afford it because we're cutting defense spending.
I guess I'm wondering, is there anybody else in the world building superior weapons to what's available here? When there was the arms race, then it was understandable, but if we've got the best that there is to get, mm-hmm. then why do we need better weapons? Even if I'm a person worried about this sort of thing.
Yeah, why do we need faster planes?
Doesn't that also help our weapons industry, though? When we develop the next stage, they can sell off the second generation to other countries, and we're still ahead of them.
Yeah, I there are two or three things operating here. One is we have been, to some extent, demobilizing the military. But we can only fire all those people. We can't fire them too fast. We've been closing military bases. But the figures are we've reduced, the numbers are something like, we've cut defense spending by 40% compared with 1975. We've cut personnel by something like 25%, and we've closed 10 or 15% of our bases. And that doesn't work out. We should close 30 or 40 probably of our bases, but it is so politically touchy to close bases, and that's an issue right now. And I think you're right. We want to keep the arms companies going. There's an issue about submarines. We have a question about the next new submarine. Well, the Clinton administration wants to commit the next submarine, the design and the first two prototypes, to a particular shipyard, because otherwise they'll go out of business. But then the other issue, as I think you raised, is what do we do after we develop all these weapons? Will we sell that previous grade to foreign countries? The Persian Gulf War was good for the American arms industry because it made our weapons look superior to the French weapons and the British weapons and the, you know, Chinese weapons, Russian weapons.
Is it a true statement that the majority of the arms that are used in Africa, Asia, or Middle East, the newer arms are originated in the U.S.? But somehow I get the feeling that the Russians aren't making this stuff anymore. If they are, it's not in great quantity.
Yeah.
If there's violence in Rwanda or wherever, are a lot of those U.S. manufactured weapons that are enabling these people to do these things?
I cannot give you a comprehensive answer to that. I might mention that the bookstore manager told me to push books in the bookstore. They have a very current book on arms sales, on the U.S. arms industry. Part of our arguments with China is China has been developing some advanced weapons that they're selling, some silkworm missiles, the latest technology, whatever. So we don't have a monopoly on the arms trade. And there are some areas where foreign models are simply superior to American models. But we are the world's largest arms dealer. So we're selling a lot of stuff. And some of it comes back to haunt us. In Somalia, part of the problem in Somalia was a lot of U.S. weapons on the ground in Somalia. Weapons that we gave the Afghan rebels to fight the Russians ended up being used, I believe, in Iraq against us. So
same in Vietnam.
So there is a market in American weapons, you know, where we have a good weapon, it can find its way into someone else's hands and be used against us or against our interests. Yeah. Anti-missile defenses are also an issue. Some of the new Republicans, especially in the House, believe in Star Wars or something like that and want to spend more money on anti-missile defenses. But that runs against the budget deficit issue. They're also upset we're having talks right now with the Russians about defining what sort of missiles, like the Patriot missile that was used in the Persian Gulf War, what sort of local missiles actually might be used for international, for strategic defense. And do they violate the ABM agreement? So there's some technical issues that are being debated here. The Republicans want to allow us to develop and deploy a couple missile systems that might be used in intercontinental defense. The administration may trade that away in their talks with the Russians.
That's interesting. You'd say the Patriot missile, because that's a 40-year-old missile.
Yeah, and it's not, that is not the missile that's at issue. It is some missiles we're working on right now, and we're apparently extending the range, or extending their capabilities in some ways. And the Russian, I'm sorry, that's twice. The Republicans like, I must have a thing.
Same category.
The Republicans like, you know, like those missiles, want to have the chance to develop them and potentially to deploy them, and are afraid that the Clinton administration may give that up. And the concern is really the terrorist concern more than the concern about Russia. It's not that we fear that Russia may go after us, but the missiles might come from somewhere else. And I might mention one other little thing I ran across. I have a friend who is Chinese and is apparently from a very political family in the regime in China. And after we let the, if you remember this incident recently, where the president of Taiwan was given the visa so he could come to the United States, and you recall that we had just a week or two earlier completed a round of talks about the non-proliferation treaty. What the Chinese did right after those talks were completed, they went out and did an underground test. Where what we'd been working on was agreeing not to have any underground tests anymore. They immediately go out and have an underground test at the same time that we're making this agreement. And then a week or two later, just days after we publicly announced we're letting the Taiwanese president into the U.S., they test a mobile missile that has an 8,000-mile range, which could reach the U.S. Now, I'm not saying that the Chinese are threatening us, but they let us know, don't monkey around with us. So that this issue, the anti-missile defense issue, is a real issue. One last thing that I would mention. The Republicans have been talking about Eastern Europe, and they have been real attracted to the idea that places like Poland or Czechoslovakia ought to be allowed to join NATO. This is something where Clinton made his initiative a year and a half ago. He launched this Partnership for Peace, which was about making this possible. Clinton trod a very careful line about trying to open opportunities to these countries and at the same time not provoke the Russians. It happened that I was in Washington and went to a briefing at the Russian embassy in January, right after this had been announced, and they were very angry about this. Not saying we shouldn't do it, just because it makes them angry, but they were very angry about this and let us know. It was mostly college students and a few faculty. But it's hard to see what the Congress can do without really getting us in more of a mess. So that's another problem right now. Well, that's a survey. These are the general themes. Actually, I prepared another sheet that has some more specific details, but we don't have time. Do you have any other thoughts or comments in terms of the general trend? What the Republicans are... Let me say one last thing. Jesse Helms has been the strongest Republican presence within the Congress in defining a general foreign policy attitude. It tends to be anti-communist, it's anti-Cuba, it's anti-China. He has had support from a number of Republicans in the House of Representatives. Many of the new Republicans in the House support Jesse Helms' ideas more so than the Senate does. So that he's actually, he's pushing his ideas farther in the House, even though he's a senator. He's chairing the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.